So start talking. Yeah, we're good.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time this afternoon to come to our session. We delayed lunch for the entire conference so that you could have this session now. Spencer and I have been the lead architects on CPS, started a journey a couple years ago. And today we'll be walking through a bit of the deep dive into what cloud platform systems is. I'll start off by providing a brief overview, and then Spencer will dive into more of a deep dive into the specific components of networking, compute, and storage, and then conclude with a brief overview of management. How many people have been able to see the CPS booth on the showroom floor? Raise your hands. Great. So hopefully this will provide some of a bit of a foundational overview in terms of the architectural concepts that went into CPS, and then a bit of a deep dive in some of the configuration information. It is, if you've seen the back of the rack, there's a few wires there. And this will walk through what is the underpinning of all those wires. For those that haven't been to the booth or weren't at VGA's presentation yesterday, I highly recommend that you go to the booth and that you look at VGA's overview of what is CPS yesterday. But let me just provide a brief grounding on what is the cloud platform system. So it's a joint project between Microsoft and Dell, Dell providing the hardware and some of the software infrastructure, and then Microsoft providing the rest of the system. It's hardware, which is a little different for us. It starts at a single rack intended to create a private cloud solution for enterprises and hosters. And then it scales up to a total of four racks. The system is completely integrated in terms of the management, compute, storage, and networking. It includes Windows Server 2012 R2, System Center 2012 R2, and Windows Azure Pack. It is, in short, a Azure-consistent cloud in a box. We've even went further than that, and we've actually integrated all of the support. You have what we call a single throat to choke. If anything goes wrong, you call Microsoft. And so there's no vendor arguments when you start deploying this at scale as to whose issue you're having. You call Microsoft, and we resolve it. On the hardware side, then, it's a combination of Dell PowerEdge servers, Dell JBODs, their dense storage enclosures, and Dell networking switches. The software stack starts at the bottom on this. Of course, we have all the Dell hardware components. We've worked very closely together to qualify the hardware at scale. And then sitting on top of that, you, of course, have Windows Server running Hyper-V as the core foundation of what we call software-defined compute. And then we have, for software-defined networking, all of the Hyper-V networking virtualization, the overlay network, effectively, if you're familiar with that. And then on the software-defined storage side of things, we use a combination of a scale-out file server with storage spaces. So that's the core fabric infrastructure that's created from the hardware. And then on top of that, we layer System Center, specifically Virtual Machine Manager, Operations Manager, to be able to manage the stamp at scale with a whole lot of automation. And then the back end of that is SQL Server to be able to track all of the eventing and all the configuration information. And then we layer on top of that a portal, the Windows Azure Pack portal, so we have consistency with Azure. And then all of the systems management REST APIs that are used in Azure are also used in the cloud platform system. So this solution is prepackaged. And so the rack comes completely pre-wired, pre-tested, with all of the software installed. And so from the time what we call dock to live, when it arrives at your shipping dock to when you're live with tenant workloads is days. And our experience with our partners is that traditionally that can be months, certainly at least weeks, to be able to pull that off. Whereas with this integrated solution, it's days. It's a very different world. One of the things we've learned with private cloud deployments with our hosters and enterprise partners is that agility is key. The other side of what we've created with this is we've seen with those partners that they need a lot of fault tolerance. They want their tenant workloads to just keep working. And so in general, we've designed in what we call N+2 fault tolerance, where you can take two faults in any of the different subcomponents and everything continues to work. There's no service outage from the tenant's perspective. And then for networking, we actually do what we call N+1. We have two switches, and so any switch can die, and all of the traffic will transparently fail over to the other switch. So one of the cornerstones of the architecture is its fault tolerance. The other cornerstone is the integrated management. And so as I've already mentioned, it comes in completely set up for you. But the other side is being able to have an integrated solution to take your virtual machines, configure them, deploy them, patch them in a fully automated way. So a tenant can come in, deploy VMs, and the hoster or the admin is in no way involved. It's completely the tenant managing their own virtual resources. We also integrate backup and disaster recovery. There's an awful lot of automation infrastructure that we provide to make simple tasks, what used to be complex tasks, quite simple. With the hardware that we've got then, what we're able to do is deploy up to 8,000 of what we call extra small VMs, and up to 1.1 petabytes of reliable storage as you scale all the way to the 4-rack solution. Again, just providing a brief overview of what is CPS for those that missed the talk yesterday by Vijay. This provides some of the summary speeds and feeds. I won't go into it in any real detail. But just to give you some of the feel for the scope of this hardware, a single rack gives you 512 cores of compute resources, a total of 8 terabytes of RAM, 260 terabytes of usable storage. So it's a fairly large system. We'll be walking into some of the, I'll be walking through some of the constructs of where those numbers come from. The other side is the network infrastructure is a beast. And I'll walk through why we felt this was required, but you can see from the numbers here that we have a really insane amount of network bandwidth within this infrastructure. And even going off what we call stamp, the management domain we call a stamp, and so the stamp can be from 1 rack to 4 racks. Even going off stamp, we can provide up to 60 gigabits per second of networking. And of course, the rack is a little heavy, 2,300 pounds, 16.6 kilowatts, worst case. And then we have some close partners that we've worked with. Of course, Dell is the lead partner. But component partners, Chelsea, Mellanox, F5, Avago, and Intel are also an integral part of this solution. So that's my very brief summary of what is CPS. Let me then take a step back and talk a bit about some of the architectural goals that we had when we created the system. First, of course, we wanted to start with some fairly proven ideas and concepts. We felt Azure has deployed at scale worldwide, and there's an awful lot of learnings that we can take from them. And so, of course, at its most basic level, we're using the same Windows Server, the same hypervisor. But honestly, private cloud is not just about virtualization. Virtualization is a journey we've all been on for the last 10 years. That's not really the new thing here. When you move into a private cloud world, it's much, much more than just simply virtualization. It's really about being able to deploy services. And so there's two fundamental different service models that we've worked with Azure on. One is called infrastructure as a service, and the other is platform as a service. For infrastructure as a service, the goal is to be able to deploy virtual machines, but do it in a way that the administrator is not directly involved. You have tenants, you have customers that can come in, and they can self-service their VMs. They can self-deploy them, they can manage them, and it's only that edge case where the hoster administrator is actually pulled in. And so when you deploy IaaS, you're deploying customer virtual machines. When you deploy platform as a service, you actually want to be able to provide higher density solutions than that, potentially have a single virtual machine that's shared across multiple tenants. This is where we do things like high density websites. And so specifically in terms of the Azure Consistent Cloud in a Box, we are providing the same portal that Azure provides, and we're also providing the Azure high density websites. Those are two of the key areas that we're leveraging from the work in Azure. And then there's some other areas that are more kind of design concept in scope. One, as we've seen from Azure, is that you must efficiently use the hardware. One of the worst things you can do in private cloud is have orphaned resources, where you pay for a lot of compute or you pay for a lot of storage, and because of the way the software or the system has been architected, you're not able to use it. And I'll be walking through what that means, but fundamentally you want to pack as many VMs as you humanly can, because that comes back to customer revenue for a hoster, for example, and you want to use all of the storage you have in the most efficient way possible. And then the other side of it that we found, again through our Azure learnings, is the use of network offloads is actually critical. And so we'll be walking through some of the network offloads that we've bet on and some of the performance numbers that we get because of that offload. Because when you think about it, two of the most costly components of a private cloud is the CPU and the memory. And so you want to use those resources as efficiently as possible. And what we found is providing these network offloads actually makes it so that your hardware is much more efficient. Lastly, the other component that we've seen from Azure is that dynamic scaling is key. You're actually not really service-oriented if you're not able to dynamically scale the service from, say, one VM to a very large number of VMs. We need to have dynamic scaling of the VM. To be able to achieve that, you need to have an integrated hardware load balancer, or integrated load balancer, and then you also need to be able to incrementally scale the hardware. And so with CPS, we start with one rack, but as your needs grow, you can then deploy a second rack, a third rack, or a fourth rack. So we start with 2,000 VMs, extra small in size, with a single rack, and then you can scale that up to four to get a total of 8,000 VMs of capacity. So just to kind of anchor some of the points that I made in the prior slide, so one of the key issues around not having orphaned resources is that you can efficiently pack your VMs and your storage wherever there's idle capacity. And so with CPS, we have four racks, and so across those, or up to four racks, and across that, what you want to be able to do is, as you're, for instance, deploying 10 new VMs with associated storage, you might have, say, five VMs that are extra small and two VMs that are extra large and a couple other VMs in the middle. And it might be, say, in rack two, you've got some idle capacity that's fine to host the extra small VMs. Rack four, you've got idle capacity that's suitable to host the extra large virtual machines. And then in rack one, say, you've got storage capacity available to host the actual storage for those virtual machines. In the old architecture, on the left-hand side, the traditional deployment model, that actually has serious performance problems if you try to do that. The issue is that as you come out of the top of the rack switch, the top of the rack switch, in this case I'm showing an example where, so you've got a couple top-of-rack switches and you're in a fault-tolerant mode. So within the rack, you have a crossbar. So the bisectional bandwidth that you see is, for example, 1,360 gigabits per second. It's got excellent scaling. And then you go off-rack, and you have some fairly expensive aggregation switch. And you typically don't get very many links. You might have one or two, 10 or 20 gigabits per second. And so you can see that the network bandwidth, if you're trying to talk to resources off of the rack, falls off by one or two orders of magnitude. It's something you absolutely want to optimize for. You want to try to fit all of your resources in one rack. If they don't fit in one rack, you have idle resources. So you end up with effectively orphaned resources being common. What we did in CPS and what was originally done with Microsoft Research and then deployed in the Azure cloud is what we call a flat network. In a flat network, you can see from the graphic on the bottom right, what we use is those same topper rack switches, but we've now used them everywhere, and we use a lot of parallel links. And so because of that, we can do what we call equal cost multipath routing. And so we have parallel links coming out of the topper rack switch to what we call the aggregation switch at the next layer. It's actually cheaper in many ways because we're not dealing with this expensive switch at that second layer. And it's highly fault tolerant because you have all these parallel links that are being used at the same time. And so because of that, within CPS, coming off rack, we have 560 gigabits of network bandwidth, bidirectional network bandwidth, that's in a highly fault-tolerant configuration. Thus, you can place your VMs and your storage wherever you have idle capacity. You can bin pack extremely efficiently with CPS. So that's one aspect, is being able to pack as many virtual machines into the stamp as possible. And then the other aspect is being able to efficiently access the network and the storage across that highly parallel configuration. And so what we did, what we found is there's, we actually like two different kinds of offloads. One is to provide tenant isolation, we use Hyper-V network virtualization, or HNV. That basically creates an overlay network. And so the traditional model without what's called NVGRE task offload is that it's all done in software. And in software, you know, I showed in the prior slide the amount of amazing bandwidth we have going into a single node. Spencer will be diving into it in a little bit. But into a single node, we have 40 gigabits per second of bandwidth, 20 gigabits per second just for the Hyper-V network, for the virtualization network, what we call the tenant network. And so you can see here there's four different transfer models. One is being able to communicate from one VM to another VM. What's the maximum bandwidth you can achieve? And without this offload, without this NVGRE task offload, we're only getting 4 gigabits per second out of a total possible of 20 gigabits per second. And that's honestly with a lot of CPU utilization, which makes it so you can pack fewer virtual machines in because you're using so much CPU to be able to access the network. And then the other side is because of this overlay network, we need gateways to be able to get off stamp to the physical network. And so we have three different kinds of gateways in CPS. Again, this is an integrated solution, so we've thought through all of the different modes that you'd want to be able to communicate off stamp. And so we have what's called a forwarding gateway, which is just a straightforward translation from the virtualized network onto the physical network external to the stamp. And then we also have what's called a NAT gateway, as well as a site-to-site gateway. The site-to-site gateway is actually encrypting the traffic going off, so it has a bit lower bandwidth. But you can see in all three of these, the bandwidth is anything quite a bit less than spectacular. Our original version of CPS was built on top of the Sandy Bridge processor from Intel. And so with network offloads, we were able to achieve 12 gigabits per second from one virtual machine to another virtual machine. The test configuration is on the left-hand side. I won't spend any time on it. I'll let you read that offline. And then the gateway functionality is roughly 5.5, 6 gigabits per second, and then the site-to-site is 1.3. What we've actually then shipping CPS on is the Ivy Bridge processor, where you see we get 18 gigabits per second, one VM to one VM, between two boxes, anywhere in the stamp. Doesn't matter which rack you're in. And then the site-to-site gateway, the different gateway functionalities, you can see what the numbers are. But you end up with a fairly spectacular amount of network bandwidth that's available to a single VM. And then that scales very nicely as you then pack these VMs as tightly as possible. The storage also we've thought through pretty carefully. On the storage side of things, so CPS has disaggregated storage and compute. And so we have what's called a scale-out file server. There's talks here on the scale-out file server. We have a list of talks at the end of this that you might want to go see. The scale-out file server has fairly spectacular performance. It's what we call the storage scale unit, or the SSU. And so this walks through performance for the storage. But honestly, one of the things that's different in private cloud, people used to just talk about IOPS. And that's no longer sufficient. In private cloud, actually what matters is that knee of the curve on latency. If you're a storage geek, you're pretty familiar with this, but that's part of what makes private cloud interesting, is that the people that aren't necessarily experts in each of these different technology areas must be able to reliably operate the stamp. And so one of the critical things is understanding the storage latency and whether you're overdriving the storage. And what is its true capacity? Because it's pretty trivial to overdrive things. You need to understand where that knee of the curve is. And so here we're showing both IOPS as you scale the queue depth on a per virtual machine basis, as well as the latency that the virtual machine sees to that storage. So all of this is measured within the virtual machine, talking over the 10 gig network infrastructure to the scale-out file server to the JBOD storage on the back end, the just a bunch of disk storage on the back end. And so what this is showing on the top is the read throughput that we get. If you're going to the SSD tier, we'll walk through the tiering architecture of the storage subsystem when Spencer's up on stage in a few minutes. But you can see we're getting roughly 800,000 IOPS using 8K IOPS, which is the most common workload that we see in private cloud. It's paging I/O or SQL transactional operations, that kind of thing. 8K random I/O to us is the most common workload, and so that's what we're showing here. With just 1 millisecond of latency, this is measured inside the VM. When we mix reads and writes, of course, the SSDs have slower performance on the writes than on the reads. And you see here, we're able to achieve with a 70-30 mix of reads versus writes with 8 kilobytes again, 268,000 IOPS with an average latency of 4.9 milliseconds for the writes and 2.3 milliseconds for the reads. So that's one of the other components that we've learned from Azure, is being able to ensure that you're efficiently using the hardware by using these hardware offloads. And then the other component is this dynamic scaling issue, that services and their load changes radically. And what you could do is provision your service to the maximum load that it might ever need. And then what you end up with in a scale-out model where you're deploying additional VMs is a lot of wasted resources. Because you, for instance, in the middle of the night, you have enough external load to justify a single virtual machine. But at, say, noon in the middle of the day, you need, say, 8 virtual machines to be able to satisfy the load. With CPS, you can dynamically change this. And in fact, you can actually automate it so that using virtual machine manager, specifically VM roles, I show an example of the configuration you would use for a VM role, where you use the initial instance count of 1 to show the minimum. If you actually want it to be highly available, you should set that to 2. And then in this example, allowing it to scale out to 5. And then what you can do is you can plumb Operations Manager to be able to monitor the CPU utilization in it and automatically deploy additional virtual machines, or if you so choose, you can do it manually as well. And so that allows it to dynamically scale out many, many, many VMs as your load varies, which again makes it so you're, one, able to pack as many VMs as you can into the stamp. It's all about revenue. And then the other side is make sure it's right size for the workload that you've got. So this example is showing dynamic scaling of, say, the web tier, where the SQL tier on the back end isn't scaling, but you can scale it at any tier. It's fully general. And then what's neat about it is Virtual Machine Manager has been tightly integrated with the hardware load balancer in CPS so that all of the configuration is done automatically through VMM. So as you deploy these additional virtual machines, it then goes in and reconfigures the hardware load balancer automatically. So I just walked through several areas of learnings where we've created this Azure consistent cloud in a box. But what we found when we went off and talked to customers, both customers that are kind of the classic enterprise customers as well as hoster customers that want to be able to deploy private cloud functionality, we found they had additional requirements. For instance, Azure, when it deploys typically 20 racks as a unit. It doesn't deploy one rack at a time. And so the minimum order from their perspective is 20 racks. Feedback from our customers is that's not a scale that is terribly interesting to them. They want something much smaller. Azure does disaggregate compute and storage. And so what they do is they deploy 20 racks of storage and 20 racks of compute. And so actually the minimum configuration is 40 racks. And that create some issues. And so what they wanted to be able to, what customer feedback is, they wanted a converged infrastructure. They wanted an infrastructure that combined in the same rack compute and storage and networking. So it was all integrated and they didn't have to deal with separate vendors for the storage versus the compute, et cetera. It's a single throat to choke. That's a great start to be able to make it sized appropriately for our customers, but there were other issues as well that are kind of unique. One, now the concept of low operational overhead clearly is shared with Azure, but we actually took it a step further with CPS. With CPS, we actually create an automated infrastructure for patching. And so we will actually pre-qualify all of the patches that we ship out for CPS. We have a very large farm of CPS racks at Microsoft that we use to test all of Windows Server and all of System Center on a daily basis. We're actually deploying 20,000 VMs a day into that infrastructure, and it'll be the entire infrastructure is moving to CPS. And so as part of that, as we're deploying these 20,000 VMs a day, which is critical to all of the development teams for Windows Server and System Center, we will test all of these patches and test the automation of all these patches every time we send out a new patch update. So one, we'll pre-qualify the patches, and two, at the customer site, they'll be able to completely automate the deployment of this. This is done through leveraging all of the fault tolerance that we have in the infrastructure. What we effectively do is we shed load off of whatever it is we're patching, be that firmware, drivers, Windows Server patches, System Center patches, et cetera. We'll take load off of that component, bring it out of the resource pool, patch it, test it to make sure it's operating correctly, and then bring it back into the resource pool by moving that load back to that node. And then we go to the next node. And so it's this sequential thing, so it takes a little while, but there is zero downtime to the tenant, and it's fully automated. So it creates that low operational overhead. The feedback from our customers is that's one of the biggest costs of operational overhead is patching. Whether it's Windows patching, System Center's patching, patching of driver firmware, et cetera. So that combination of integrated patching, full testing at scale on a regular basis, and then, of course, the other side of it is you have to have that integrated management. And so what we've chosen to do with CPS is we're building off of Virtual Machine Manager and Operations Manager in SMA, which is a very familiar tool set to the enterprise and to hosters to create that very low operational overhead. And because it's all pre-configured, we can actually tune those packages to make sure that they're operating extremely well with very low overhead. Lastly, I talked briefly about the fault tolerance of the infrastructure. And let me just walk through that to some degree. So first off, this drawing is kind of a logical drawing of CPS. Not all the wires are shown, et cetera. But fundamentally, we have a set of compute servers, what we call the compute scale unit. We have a set of scale-out file servers. And then sitting behind that, we have a whole bunch of disks, both SSDs and hard disk drives, in JBOD enclosures. And so there's an awful lot of hardware components here that can fail, hardware and software. And so one of the foundational concepts we have is we don't like active-passive. The problem with active-passive links is that you don't know for sure that the passive portion is actually up. And so if the active side goes down and you fill everything over to the passive side, you're kind of crossing your fingers hoping everything will work. If you're using it in active-active mode, then both links or both subsystems are being used at the same time, making it so you're certain that if that failure occurs, you can fail over and continue to proceed. And then what we've done by studying the failure modes in Azure is we've tuned the amount of fault tolerance we have to make sure it's just the right amount of fault tolerance. And so what we've learned from Azure is actually the single largest failure in the hyperscale cloud is hard disks. And so what we do there is we have what we call N plus 2 fault tolerance. So we can take out two disk drives, for instance, in any volume and not lose any data and actually still be available. And we do this, for instance, in this case, I've got the red disks that then have mirrored copies of data on other JBODs, the green disks. And so we can then rebuild that fault tolerance transparently and in parallel to get back to that same level of redundancy. And so we can handle two drives failing. We can handle two file servers failing, still be fully operational. We can handle at least two compute servers failing in both the management infrastructure as well as the tenant compute infrastructure. And then we've tuned it so that for other components, we only go with N plus 1 fault tolerance. So we can handle one fault completely transparently with no downtime from the tenant's perspective. And so if that little SAS link there, the connectivity between the file server and the JBODs are what we call shared SAS. If that wire fails, or the expander on the JBOD fails, or the HBA interface fails, then we have an alternate path. And so you can see here I show a green path to that JBOD enclosure. And then if that green path fails, you can then it'll dynamically reroute all the traffic over the yellow link to be able to get to that hard disk drive. The same is true for JBODs. We can have an entire JBOD enclosure fail, continue to run with no problems. The same is true for network interfaces, network cables. For a single compute node, it has two cables coming out in an active-active configuration. And so if one of them fails, we just transparently fail over all the traffic to the other link. The same is true for switches. We have a basically an A network and a B network in the infrastructure so that if a switch fails, we're still, again, fully fault tolerant. There's no downtime from the tenant's perspective. So all of this creates a very fault tolerant infrastructure. What's been fascinating to us is it's one thing to architect it. It's another to put it together and to test it at scale. What we found was, even though we had all these redundant links in, when we actually put it together, built it at scale, This is, I think, some of the customer pain that comes into these kinds of solutions. There was an awful lot of bugs in the system. And so we had to get through all of these bugs, testing at scale. We built a new tool we call the Private Cloud Simulator that brings the cloud up to full load. So in the case of a single rack, 2,000 VMs. In the case of four racks, 8,000 VMs. And then start shooting all these different components in parallel and making sure in testing to make sure that the tenant services never go down, the management services never go down, the storage never goes down. And so by doing that, and then we actually do an accelerated function of that. So we're killing everything all over the place while it's under full load, and it has to stay that way for 2 weeks before we'll ship. And so that amount of failure mode we would expect to see at a customer site over the course of a year. It's extremely rigorous. And it allowed us to be able to work through all of the integration issues as all these components have to work together and make sure that the fault tolerance that we've designed into the system is actually realized by the customer. Let me move on then and talk a bit about the converged infrastructure. So as I talked about previously, customers were telling us what they really wanted was a combined storage, compute, and networking in one rack. It's completely converged. And then on top of that, we layer software to create software-defined networking, compute, and storage with that integrated management. The way we do that is we have what we call scale units. And so we have what we call a storage scale unit. It's a physical concept. We have a compute scale unit and a network scale unit. And then, of course, as we add racks, up to four racks for CPS, we then have more scale units that we then manage. And so within that, we can have, as this shows, four storage scale units, four compute scale units, et cetera. And then within that, we divide up what we call failure domains. And so we have a storage failure domain using Windows failover clustering. And then within the compute scale unit, we then carve out a portion of it because we want the management infrastructure to have an independent fault domain. And so it's completely independent, provides that N plus 2 fault tolerance guarantee. And the management infrastructure in that first rack actually manages, is sized specifically to be able to manage from one rack to four racks. And then we also have what we call a network edge to be able to do that translation from the Hyper-V overlay network off to the off-stamp physical network. And so that's also fault tolerant. And then the rest of the compute resources are used for tenant compute, again in a failover clustering. So if any nodes fail, we'll dynamically shed the load to functional nodes. And then as we then scale that going into the second, third, and fourth rack, we don't need to allocate resources for the management infrastructure because that management infrastructure has been specifically sized to go all the way to four racks. And so as we go to the rest of it, we then use those compute resources for tenant workloads. And then from a virtual machine perspective, we then group them into what we call an edge host group, a management host group, and a compute host group. So that's my very brief overview of the architectural concepts that went into CPS. And now Spencer will be walking through a bit more of a deep dive into those concepts with the real configuration we have in CPS. Spencer?
Good afternoon. Thanks, Jim. So I'm going to go through some of the details of networking, compute, and storage, talking a little bit about the hardware, the choices we made, and how we kind of integrate that. And so kind of playing off of Jim's introduction, we'll kind of work through those pieces.
So as you've seen through Jim's presentation so far, CPS has quite a bit of networking content within it. And this slide summarizes essentially the three physical networks within the CPS stamp. The reason we do this is to provide traffic separation between different traffic content and allows for our ability to take advantage of different hardware capabilities within the stamp itself, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. The first or of the three physical networks is the front end of the tenant network, and that contains essentially everything that's outbound from the stamp. So this is all of the internet traffic that'll come into the stamp, or intranet traffic if you're self-contained on a corporate network. And then it will also provide all of the Hyper-V network virtualization content capabilities as well. So this is where the HNV gateway and the site-to-site gateway exist within the content. And then we encapsulate and carry the HNV content across this front-end or tenant network. One of the other pieces of content that's on this network is the hardware load balancer. So this is the capability for us to provide scale-up networking services for those services that need to, you know, spin up additional VMs as a result of overall service workload or load balancing just in general for the service that's provided. So the separation then for the tenant network allows us to use the physical network of the, we use the Mellanox adapters you'll see later to allow for us to do effective HMV characteristics or HMV encapsulation of the network traffic on the front end. On the back end network, then we carry all of the data center traffic. This includes primarily the tenant storage or scale-up file server content. So everything within CPS for data access is stored on the scale-out file server and then accessed through the data center network from the tenant VM. So all the VHDs and VHDXs that are used within the solution are stored on the scale-out file server, and the use of a separate network then allows us to offer some that separation physically and some quality of service, given that the tenant, the front-end and the back-end networks are not going to interact from a traffic workload standpoint. And then we can take advantage of the capabilities of the network adapters on the backend network that provide remote data memory access or RDMA capabilities to do very efficient memory transfers. So in the case of storage, that's very advantageous in that we are able to take advantage of that and provide great services. The second is the live migration. Content will also flow over this network, and so we can do very efficient or effective live migrations between nodes within the configuration, so that goes very quickly if we need to either evacuate a node or load balance with live migration. The other thing that we use the data center network for is around CSV and spaces redirection. So if there is an instance where the scale-up file server has to redirect content, it'll be over this network as well. Finally, the other major thing that flows over the data center network is the management infrastructure. So VMM, as it interacts with hosts for configuration of VMs or the virtual switches on individual hosts, it'll reach around and connect to those servers through the data center network, so it has a separate control path to each of the hosts. Finally is the management network content. So this is the interaction with the physical hosts to do things like power cycling or control the host for reinstallation if they have to be reprovisioned for some reason. That's done over the management network, each of the physical hosts' VMC interface. And then finally, the switches, the physical network switches within the stamp are also routed within within the stamp. So the routing and content is wholly self-contained within the solution. And the switches then are also physically connected to this management network. So then we offer essentially a fully enclosed and self-consistent solution for the solution. So this is the three physical networks: the tenant, data center, and the management network.
Given that we've converged the network and we have kind of separate physical networks, how do we actually provide essentially a true separation of the, essentially running the same traffic on top of the same physical network? And I actually have a couple slides in a second that'll go through that detail. And actually, so I'm covering about a very small portion of a larger discussion that's going to happen. So Greg Cosanza has a presentation tomorrow at 5 p.m. that goes through the network configuration for CPS in a lot more detail. And so this is really kind of an overview. So just if you're interested in that detail from my coverage today, then you'll forward reference to that presentation. But this is the physical separation, and kind of leading into the question. So we actually split this up into separate logical networks. And what this means to us is that we have separate routable domains. So you can think of each of the logical networks as a different subnet within the configuration. And Jim may have alluded to it, but we're actually doing L3 routing between the racks. So what that means is that we don't take a single layer 2 physical MAC level address and try to span that across each of the racks. The difficulties with that are that the different types of link aggregation we're trying to do, along with the resiliency guarantees that we're providing, really make it difficult to do that at a layer 2 space. And so in layer 3, what we can do is use ECMP or equal cost multipath routing, so we can have links from several physical switches and have them all active. And then we use BGP as a routing protocol then to provide for the right routing that's needed within the infrastructure. So we actually, in the event of switch failure or link failures, BGP will essentially do the route updates. ECMP will provide the right kind of failover characteristics, and traffic will keep flowing in the event of those types of failures. So in the logical network, we have the infrastructure. So think back to the previous slide, kind of the functionality that we were trying to provide overall between the tenant, data center, and a management infrastructure. You'll see the infrastructure network, so that's host management, clustering, live migration, storage. So those are all essentially the things that reside on the data center network, and we bring that network through essentially routing into VMM and OM so that they have access to the back-end servers effectively to control, do physical VM deployments in virtual networking or reswitch configurations. So that all happens on the infrastructure network. BMC management, again, as I mentioned in the last slide, is really about host control, physical control of the resources within the stamp. Services is a reference to essentially the PaaS services that resides. We separate those out and put them on a separate subnet so we can control and provide separation from a logical standpoint. The external network, obviously the purpose of the stamp is to provide network access to some set of services, and that's run over a set of subnets that will provide that external access off the stamp. And so those are things going to be routed either directly to VMs on the stamp themselves or through the network virtualization side, which is going to be the NVGRE. So if I have an external address, that'll come in through essentially the forwarding gateway or the NAT gateways and then be pushed into the NVGRE space or the HMV, and that'll ride on top of the network virtualization subnet as well. Switch management goes hand in hand with the BMC piece. So, in the cases where we actually have to do switch monitoring or switch changes in configuration, those will happen over the switch management network. And the last two, the load balancer and the forwarding gateways, again, are services that are provided for essentially those tenant-facing subnets. So we can load balance content across the web services or the websites that Jim mentioned in the configuration, or forwarding gateways just to allow for the virtualization overall. So this is kind of a different picture of the last description. So you can think of management, compute, storage, and the network edge as kind of general classes of hosts or services that are there. And this provides essentially the connectivity that exists between each one of those. So some of this is controlled through physical separation. For example, the storage network resides just on the data center network and is accessible through just that subnet. And then the vSwitch and its capabilities or control then provide separation to the question that from the audience was about how do we actually do separation. The first step to that is actually controlling that through the vSwitch and its ACLs, so you can actually do the traffic separation. And it shows then the compute side of the infrastructure and how it's connected to services, external, HNV, and the load balancer networks as needed. So on the right-hand side of this really kind of is a nod towards the configuration of how the physical switches are connected first to the hosts themselves, essentially that first level that first TOR connection or top rack switch, and then the second column of switches here are what we call an aggregate set of switches that provide the aggregate or pull together all of the first level switches and then provide external connectivity off the stamp as well. And so, as I said, Greg will go through in a lot more detail on how those connections are made and kind of the modes that they're configured. So specifically, so the first level access for essentially separation is through the vSwitch, as noted here from Hyper-V, but the second, the essentially the basic level of separation that occurs since we've converged all these subnets onto single set of physical switches, the problem becomes, you know, how do we actually separate the subnets? Because the physical switches are going to want to route that content for any of the subnets that they have routes for, and so there would be generally be access from one subnet to another. And what you really want in a converged infrastructure is to provide common resources, but to have the separation such that there's no interaction between those. And we do that through, like I said, a combination of vSwitch settings and then physical switch ACLs. So if you're not familiar with most of the commodity switches that are on the market, at an L3 level, you can separate subnet routing through access control lists. And so part of the configuration that we do as part of delivery to the customer is we take their IP subnets that are supposed to be placed on the stamp, we configure the switch infrastructure in its entirety, and then place the ACL configurations on the stamp as well to match the separation that needs to be in place for the design and the overall architecture that we have for the stamp. And so we do that to pull all that apart and make sure that there's no security access or, you know, security issues between access between those different subnets. And so this is essentially the outline of, if you take the logical networks that I described, and then this is the separation that occurs between those logical networks. The most important ones to separate are really the BMC and switch managements, meaning that when you make sure that the physical access or the physical resources in the stamp have restrictions in place, so that it's not accessible either off stamp or from the other services and external networks, because you're going to have tenant-facing services there, people that can create VMs and potentially, you know, pose a threat to the stamp's services themselves. And so we provide that separation through the ACL control in the switches. The other thing that we integrate from a hardware perspective is load balancing. So we use the F5 load balancers in the configuration. And this provides the ability to scale both not only the tenant workloads, but also the management services themselves. So we can take and scale up and down, as Jim described, automatically, and the F5 load balancer provides the hardware capability to do that. And we use two chassis, again, kind of looking at fault tolerance. We do two chassis and one controller per chassis. That gives us the scalability, but also the separation for faults, or actually hardware servicing, et cetera. And just a brief overview of kind of how the connections are built in the system with the load balancer and how they're redirected between the front end and back end. So as you can see, the external network is connected at the bottom. Load balancer then provides services, like I mentioned, for the load balancer network, which is essentially those tenant VMs, traditional web services, et cetera, but then also the services and the infrastructure network for the management infrastructure. So to talk a little bit about the Dell hardware that we use in the configuration, one thing I haven't mentioned so far is, and you probably noted it from kind of the pictorial descriptions, is that we did our best to choose essentially a single component type for each of the functionality pieces that are in the stamp. So we use the same Dell Force 10 64-port 10-gig switches for the tenant data center and the aggregate switches. And so that simplifies essentially the switch type. If you were a customer that held stock on site for failures, you could buy essentially one switch or have one on stock, and then it'd be actually to be able to replace and physically service each one of the those other switches. And then for the management infrastructure, we use the S55, so it's just a simple 1-gig switch in the configuration. Like I said, this gives us the right kind of connectivity then to provide the bandwidth that Jim went over, but also the resilience we need for things like ECMP and BGP routing. So moving on to the compute side. So as I mentioned, we tried to use a single component type, but we also had to try to get the right scale of density as opposed to the storage. So in the single rack, we have 32 nodes. That's provided through these essentially the four server chassis, the C6220s from Dell. And it's a nice configuration because the serviceability of the sleds, you do that essentially from behind. can pull one sled out without disrupting any of the other servers within the configuration, so it's a very straightforward servicing model. Even though the servers can use or can be populated with 24 disks in its entirety for the enclosure, we only use a single SSD for each of the servers for the local OS and boot drive. So we don't really load much storage there at all, just the single SSD. And the reason we went for a single SSD is since everything is virtualized in the configuration, it's only for that OS local disk and paging. And the SSDs have a much lower failure rate than hard disk drives. And so if there is an SSD failure, it should be relatively infrequent, and we can reprovision that host quickly. And the services that had been running on that node in case of a disk failure would be moved on to one of the other nodes within the cluster. So it's just a little bit of a, you'll see the full configuration down on the show floor, but I wanted to point out a couple things in the from a cabling standpoint. And I'll have to apologize because this is a picture that came from one of the racks that we have in Redmond. This is our test rack, so it has a few extra cables that are used for kernel debugging, but it generally represents the configuration. Now, while it might actually look confusing and messy, it's actually very clean. We took a lot of time with Dell to work through how to do the integration of the hardware in a way that we could service individual components without disrupting anything else within the stamp. So we went through and looked at and serviced and tried to service essentially any component that was hot pluggable or would be serviced as part of a normal stamp lifetime. We made sure that we actually had the cabling in place that we could remove cables just for a single component, had access to slide that component out of the rack, either front or behind, and actually do that servicing work without, like I said, without that disruption. And so this is just the componentry here on the, so this is the 8 chassis for the 32 nodes, and you'll see the individual cabling for the 4 10 gig interfaces in the single BMC connection. And so what we can do with one of those single servers then is to pull the network cables off. All the cables are labeled so that you can get them back in the right place instead of having to tape and remember where they go, and then slide that blade out, do the servicing work, slide it back in, recable, and you're ready to go. So this is a separate depiction of the things I've described before, and I kind of want to walk through and emphasize the failure modes that Jim had talked about. So each of the compute nodes has 4 10 gig interfaces, as I described, as 3 physical separate networks. And those are represented at the top here, what I would refer to as the northbound interfaces. Those are the tenant interfaces. Those 2 Mellanox interfaces are actually come off and split between 2 physical servers. And we use the Windows load balancing and failover capability to aggregate those 2 physical interfaces into 1 logical network interface that that Windows uses for communication outbound. And then we use a mechanism between the 2 switches called MC-LAG, so multi-chassis link aggregate group or stack switching. So we take those 2 physical separate switches. We have 3 10 gig NICs or links between those 2 switches. And what that provides for then is that if one of these links fails from the physical host or is removed or has some fault, the host will move traffic then over to the other link and route through to the other switch in the configuration. And so what that then provides for, as Jim described, essentially is the protection against single link failure from the individual host. And then we have to use the MC-LAG capability. So for all the traffic that's incoming from the aggregate switches, that fault isn't published essentially northbound. It doesn't go any further than that first level switch. And so if there's any traffic that is flowing back into the compute node or into the host, then it can pick any or either of these 2 switches at the top, and then the MC-LAG connection provides for the ability to move that traffic over to the switch that actually has physical access to the server. And so that provides for those resiliency characteristics. And then each of the these switches are then connected to 2 aggregate switches, and so if I have a failure in either a switch or an aggregate switch, then I still have connectivity within the stamp. The same is true for the bottom. You'll notice that there isn't any MC-LAG connection. The reason for that is that SMB as a file sharing protocol provides for link or switch failure through the multi-channel capabilities of SMB. So SMB is able to take multiple network interfaces or multiple network links, utilize those equally, so it will use them to both scale throughput, but also to provide for failure recovery modes. And so in the case of SMB, we didn't need to provide for a switch-to-switch link, so it can still provide for access to data in the case of an individual switch or link failure, as Jim walked through. So we're able to provide that disaggregated storage in a resilient way because of the network infrastructure and then the underlying storage configuration. Yes, there is a question.
Mm-hmm. What kind of interface do you use effectively in order to connect to the service provider network? Assume you have the ARC, another location, and you connect the two CPS in those two locations.
Yeah. Right.
What do you use normally in this case? Because the performance slide, you mentioned 1.8 gigabit per second side to side, and this is really very small compared to what is available on the fiber channel, 16 gigabit per second.
Right. So the so there's several questions you asked. One is mainly about what's the network configuration look like off stamp, and then what is the essentially overall throughput then to the storage clusters themselves. So the second question, the storage cluster question, I'll come to in a little bit later on. So we'll kind of address kind of what the capabilities are of the scale out file server. I'm sorry. Yeah, then I'll go through that now. So so each one of these aggregate switches in a full four rack configuration has available to essentially 6 10 gig links that are open to the customer. So from each rack, you can do 60 gigabits of northbound or off stamp traffic. And so if you wanted, so that's just a single rack, or essentially a single switch. So in a one rack configuration, you'd have 120 gigabits of essentially off stamp capability, and that's really up to the customer to provide the right set of networking infrastructure to do that connectivity. If you do racks 2, 3, and 4, racks 1 and 2 will have 120 gigabits. Racks 3, because you've added another aggregate switch, will add another 60 gigabits of capability for 180, and then if you go to a four rack configuration, if you were to do a fully connected, would be 240 gigabits of off-stamp connectivity outside of the network.
Do you use LACP here?
So the question is whether we do LACP. Okay. Yeah, that's fine. We'll do questions.
We're not going anywhere. We're happy to take questions through the lunch hour.
Or we can
do have lots
booth.
Of great slides. So
yeah.
Sorry.
So let me, that's a different representation. So let's move on to the storage, and I'll answer some of the questions that have come up. Let's move on. There we go. So in the storage configuration, there's two main components we use. We try to use the same server type that we did for the compute side, but because of the number of PCIe cards that we had to have for the configuration, we went with the Dell R620s. And so that provides us the RDMA networking that we need for the Chelsea adapter for connectivity. So that's 20 gigabits per file server. And in a four file server configuration, then we have 80 gigabits of unidirectional throughput then from the file server cluster. The other component that we use is a dense enclosure. So we use the MD3060 that provides us 60 disks of capacity. And the way we load that is with 48 hard drives and 12 SSDs, and we use the storage spaces tiering capability to provide both capacity and the performance we need for the configuration. And just briefly, the configuration, or for the storage servers, we use just the Chelsea adapters. There is no tenant interface, and the BMC is active just for the individual host control. In this configuration, as I mentioned, we use four file servers and four of the enclosures, and the diagram on the right provides essentially the set of services at the top that are stood up on top of the physical hardware. So we're using storage spaces three different pools or storage space pools for the config. NTFS is a file system on top of that, and then SMB3 is a file sharing protocol, and CSV is there for namespace and the redirection capabilities to access all the storage from all the file servers. On the back end of this configuration, then, we're using a shared SASC cabled config, so each of the file servers has two of the LSI or Avago dual port HBAs, and that, given the cabling configuration, that gives us access to all four of the enclosures on two paths of disk access so that we can, as Jim described, survive a single enclosure failure or link failure or HBA failure, or in the given that we're using storage spaces in a three-way mirror for the tenant workloads, we can survive two drive failures and maintain access to data. In the case of the backup pool, we're using the dual parity spaces to provide the capacity along with dedupe and NTFS. So it's a great configuration for the overall stack. Let's move to the next depiction. What I wanted to do is kind of just briefly walk through how we use storage spaces to take the 240 individual devices and split that up into the usable storage in the configuration. And we do this in a way that, as we've described two or three times now, provides a resiliency. And we have to be careful about how the physical drives are chosen, both to provide the right level of capacity and performance, but also to provide the right type of resilience we want for the configuration. So we start off with the four enclosures, as I mentioned, 48 hard drives, 12 SSDs per enclosure. And we use a capability in storage spaces referred to as enclosure awareness. So what that does is that spaces will be able to take a physical disk, identify essentially which enclosure it exists within, and then through a set of algorithms will place data for virtual disks in the right enclosure to meet the guarantees of, in our case, the three-way mirror and then the enclosure resiliency, meaning that I can make sure that I keep those three copies of data in three separate enclosures. So I'm making sure that I'm not going to put all three copies of data in one enclosure, and if I lose access to that, that JBOD or enclosure, then I'd lose access to data. So the first thing you can think of is that we take those four enclosures and split them up into kind of three logical pieces, 16 hard drives and five SSDs in the case of the tenant pools, and two SSDs in the case of the backup pool. And so then we configure storage spaces to do that separation. So when I configure the pool, I'm going to take 80 drives for the tenant and select them such that I get them in the right enclosure and create the pool that way, and then layer the virtual disks on top of that so that we do the right allocations on that side. So it gives us the right separation, the right type of tiering that we want for the configuration, et cetera. And that really brings us to the next slide, which describes the attributes of the pools for the tenant. So I have an example here of just the tenant side. The backup is different, as I mentioned, that we use the dual parity spaces capability in 2012 R2 for essentially capacity, but for the tenant workload, we wanted to focus on performance. So we're using a three-way mirror configuration for that. And we're also using tiering. So we create out of each one of those tenant pools that I described in the previous slide, then we'll create eight virtual disks about 9.5 terabytes apiece. And the way we did the allocation, so the table below describes essentially the way we think about taking those 64 drives, look at the allocations we need for space. We leave some space available in the pool, and the reason for that is that if I have a drive failure, spaces will go ahead and rebuild on top of the available space, so you don't have to go through and immediately replace a drive. Even though it's a three-way mirror, you may be conservative and be worried about the need to do an immediate drive replacement, so a rebuild can occur. The leftover available space within the pool allows for spaces to actually do that rebuild and bring it back to a fully healthy state, actually maintaining those three copies of data. And this table goes through and describes essentially just briefly how those calculations are done. The fact that we're holding back or not allocating 6 drives worth of hard drives, so that gives us the right kind of allocation per enclosure, and doing essentially something a little bit smaller for the SSDs given the failure rates are lower. Again, taking just a brief look at the cabling we did for the JBODs, we had to work through essentially the use of the PDUs and the way the cabling was done, again, to make sure that we had access to all of the componentry within the enclosures. So with the Dell enclosures, all of the components are hot pluggable, so I can hot plug fans, power supplies, the enclosure controllers themselves, and then obviously the hard drives. And so the hard drives are really nice because we can do that through essentially a drawer mechanism that slides forward, so I don't have to disrupt any of the cabling in the back of the enclosure. And it makes a fantastic solution given the density and the availability guarantees we're trying to provide. We really don't want to move the SAS cabling forward and backward within the configuration. And so those enclosures provide, you know, disk access. You're not pulling a lot of weight forward in the rack. It's a really great solution. And in the back of the rack, we made sure that through the integration process that we had the cabling set up so that we could have access to all of those components, and went through and actually made sure that we could actually service those things. And we've gone through, you know, 2 or 3 iterations with the integration steps to make sure with the integrator that we got the cabling sequences down right. So again, these are all labeled so they're easily serviceable and we don't have to kind of remember where things go. And it works out very well. So just briefly, I want to talk. Vijay talked in a little bit more detail yesterday during his presentation about the management cluster, and I think maybe Jim and I have skipped over this fact, but all of the services within CPS, with the exception of the file servers, is virtualized. So that includes the management infrastructure and obviously the tenant workloads that exist. And that's really a key thing for both the scalability and the resiliency that we're trying to provide. So what this slide represents is the set of services that are in the management infrastructure. Essentially the numbers by each of the services indicate the number of instances that are in existence, so we can survive essentially those VMs failing individually. So for example, if I'm in the SQL cluster, and one of those 4 SQL instances fails in the VM, the SQL cluster will keep up and running. And also, if I lose the physical host that some or part of those SQL instances were running on, those will be restarted through the failover clustering capabilities onto other physical nodes. And so that provides both the, like I said, the scale, but also the resiliency that we need for the management infrastructure. So just in brief, I mean, this is a kind of the overall summary for the architecture. Is really, it's that consistency with Azure, trying to that Azure consistent cloud in a box, and providing essentially the overall density and integration and delivery model that, you know, brings down the overall cost of the solution. You don't have to spend a lot of time on the configuration because we do all that for you. It worked through essentially all the details as Jim and I have work through essentially both the high-level architecture down to the details of cable placement and integration of the overall rack, so we can make sure that we're delivering, you know, a valuable solution both in it's easily accessible and serviceable and does, you know, essentially lets you focus on the things that are provided on top of the overall solution instead of the underlying details. So there's other sessions we have that are related to either the componentry that we use within CPS or, as I mentioned, the one that's most important is probably the networking talk that's tomorrow afternoon. I'd suggest you actually go to that and hear Greg walk through the network configurations. And as always, there's several of us that at the CPS booth and the expo, please stop by and we'll go through and describe everything in more detail or find the people that can help out with questions if you have them. So, and thanks for coming.